Imagine the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
But, you know, I want you to try and strip away that usual image of just this empty, barren wasteland.
Right, which is, and that's what most people picture immediately.
Exactly. But instead, I want you to imagine it as this colossal wind-powered fertilizer dispenser.
A fertilizer
Yeah,
dispenser.
it's just constantly running day and night, and it's dispensing this highly concentrated, airborne, daily multivitamin directly into the Red Sea.
It is a wild visual, but it's incredibly accurate.
And if you were tuning into this deep dive today, you likely came here with an interest in Red Sea marine biology. You care about the coral reefs, the fish, the
The
diving.
whole ecosystem.
Right. But our stack of sources today, which, by the way, ranges from these super granular marine biology studies to high-level United Nations policy briefs, it paints this picture where those two worlds just cannot be separated.
You're completely intertwined.
Yeah, I mean, you simply cannot understand what is happening in the water without looking at the sand blowing across it.
Well, and to understand why, you have to look at the geography of the Red Sea itself because it creates a really unusual marine environment.
Right.
It's basically this very narrow, incredibly deep fissure of just vivid blue water, and it is completely walled in by two of the most massive arid expanses on the planet.
So you've got the Sahara on the west and the Arabian Desert on the east.
Exactly. And, you know, most major coastal marine ecosystems thrive on heavy, nutrient-rich river runoff.
Like the Amazon or the Mississippi dumping into the ocean.
Right. But the Red Sea doesn't have that luxury. The water itself is actually unusually poor in terrestrial nutrients.
Which means the ecosystem has to look upward, right?
Duh.
Because the wind is constantly whipping across those deserts and it's pulling up these immense clouds of dust and carrying them out over the ocean.
Yeah, it's a massive atmospheric transfer.
And I was looking at the chemical breakdown of this dust in our sources, and it is staggering. We are not just talking about inert, boring sand here.
No, not at all.
Just 1 single milligram of this desert dust per liter of seawater delivers a serious chemical cocktail. It brings a payload of nitrate, iron, manganese, zinc, and copper.
And the thing is, the delivery mechanism is microscopic, right? But the scale of its impact is absolute.
Because the corals use it.
Yeah, Red Sea corals have evolved to take up these airborne trace metals incredibly quickly. They are actively pulling these deliveries right out of the water column.
Wow.
So the vitality of the entire reef relies completely on this atmospheric tether. I mean, the desert is quite literally feeding the reef.
Which, you know, it fundamentally shifts how we have to look at marine conservation.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if the desert soil dictates the health of the sea, then the human policies governing that soil are, by definition, marine policy.
Right, you can't decouple them.
You cannot protect the reef without managing the dirt. And that geopolitical reality brings us to this massive international decision that was made at the end of August 2026.
In Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia.
Right? Where it was unanimously voted that Egypt will host the 2028 UN conference on land.
Yeah, and the specific diplomatic framework we're talking about here is the UNCCD.
UNCCD.
Right. To spell that out, it is the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. And getting that naming convention straight is actually critical
It really is, yeah.
because the UN utilizes this shared terminology across multiple treaties, and it consistently confuses the public and the media.
Oh, I fell right into that trap when I first started reading these UN briefs.
Oh, people do.
Because whenever the UN announces one of these summits, they always use the acronym COP, followed by a number. And for anyone, you know, casually following environmental news, your brain immediately defaults to climate change. You hear COP
Yeah,
and you think carbon emissions.
exactly.
So this UNCCD branding practically hides this vital land treaty right in the shadow of the massive climate summits.
Well, and the confusion all stems from the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio, because that summit was sort of the genesis for modern global environmental policy. And it birthed three distinct parallel treaties to handle different parts of the global
Okay,
crisis.
climate was just one of them.
Right. One for climate, one for biodiversity, and the third was the UNCCD, focusing on land and desertification.
Got it.
And COP merely stands for Conference of the Parties, which just means a gathering of the nations that signed the treaty.
But because those three sibling treaties were, you know, born at the same time but operate totally independently, their schedules create complete numerical chaos.
Oh, total
Like
chaos.
the climate treaty meets every single year. So because of that aggressive annual schedule, Their meetings are already deep into the 30s.
Yeah, they've had a lot of them.
If you read a historical reference to COP18 in a climate context, that summit already happened in Doha way back in 2012.
But the UN Desertification Convention moves on a completely different timeline. They only convene every 2 years.
Right.
So they are only just now reaching their 18th meeting, which is going to be that 2028 summit in Egypt.
And lumping them all under that COP umbrella, I mean, it's more than just a minor branding issue. It obscures the distinct stakes of the land convention.
It does. It really does.
It mentally sends people to the wrong conference. People assume the debate is about atmospheric carbon when the fight is actually about topsoil and groundwater and dust.
And the stakes for those terrestrial resources are incredibly high right now.
Yeah. The financial leverage alone proves this isn't just some, you know, ceremonial gathering of diplomats shaking hands over sand dunes.
No, not at all. At that 2026 conference in Mongolia, the delegates authorized and distributed $1.3 billion globally.
$1.3 billion.
Yeah, specifically for land restoration and drought resilience programs.
Which is a massive influx of capital. But handing out money is often sort of the easiest part of international diplomacy.
Oh, for sure. Handing out money is the fun part.
Because reading through the breakdown of that Mongolia summit, the actual geopolitical friction came from how to handle future crises, and they completely failed to resolve it.
Yeah, the negotiations over a comprehensive global drought framework completely stalled out.
They just hit a wall.
They hit a wall regarding the enforcement mechanisms of the framework. So they ended up just punting that massive diplomatic fight straight to the 2028 conference.
So Egypt is inheriting a summit with this multi-billion dollar unresolved standoff just baked into the agenda.
Exactly.
And based on the statements from Egyptian officials in our sources, they are not walking in as neutral mediators.
No, Egypt has a lot on the line.
Yeah, Egypt's water minister, Hani Sealam, he's publicly drawn a really hard line. He is actively demanding a drought protocol that is legally binding rather than just a voluntary set of guidelines.
And that distinction between voluntary pledges and a legally binding framework, I mean, that changes the entire global approach to resource management.
Because it forces their hand?
Right. A legally binding protocol forces nations to fundamentally alter their agricultural practices and water conservation efforts under threat of international consequence.
Well.
And for a nation like Egypt, voluntary measures are just no longer sufficient to secure their future.
And to understand how Egypt plans to, you know, maneuver this highly contentious fight in 2028, you really have to look at who is steering the UN convention itself.
Oh, this is fascinating.
The sources highlight this individual whose career arc perfectly embodies this exact intersection of marine and terrestrial policy we're unpacking today. Yasmin Fawad.
Yes. So Yasmin Fawad served as Egypt's Minister of Environment for an extended tenure from 2018 through 2025.
Okay.
And during her time in that role, she initiated major marine conservation efforts. In fact, in September 2024, she finalized and signed a comprehensive 6-year, $14 million program explicitly designed to protect Egypt's coral reefs.
Okay, so she locks in the paperwork and the funding to protect the coral reefs in the ocean in late 2024.
Right.
Then, merely months later, in May 2025, she pivots and becomes the head of the UNCCD. She goes from directly managing the ocean to running the global authority on dirt. I mean, it is incredibly rare for human policy in someone's diplomatic career to reflect the physical mechanics of the natural world so perfectly.
It's like she is the human embodiment of this deep dive.
Totally. She literally signed the paperwork for the coral, and now she runs the convention for the dirt.
And her dual background gives her a highly specific vantage point for this 2028 summit.
How so?
Because she understands from direct administrative experience that the mechanisms degrading Egypt's arable land are intrinsically linked to the health of its surrounding waters.
Right.
The geography of Egypt practically forces you to view the environment through that integrated lens.
Yeah, and looking at the topographical data in the sources, the geographic reality of Egypt is terrifying.
It is stark.
The country is essentially 1 million square kilometers of desert. And out of that vast territory, at most, only 4% of the land is farmable.
Just 4%.
4% of the land mass has to sustain the entire agricultural output of the nation.
Correct.
So every single inch of arable soil is critical infrastructure.
And the most alarming data point regarding that 4% is actually where the most aggressive land degradation is happening.
Oh, right.
The worst desertification is not happening deep inland out in the middle of the Sahara interior like you might think.
That's what I would assume.
Right. But it's localized almost entirely exactly where the land meets the water, the coastline.
Which seems so counterintuitive. When people hear desertification, you naturally picture this dry wasteland just slowly expanding outward.
Yeah, like sand dunes creeping over a farm.
Right. But this is a completely different mechanism, right? It's called saltwater intrusion.
Exactly. So beneath the coastal soil, there are these natural freshwater aquifers.
Okay.
And because freshwater operates under its own hydrostatic pressure, it pushes outward toward the sea, which creates a sort of subterranean barrier.
But as coastal populations and agricultural sectors pump that groundwater to the surface faster than natural rainfall can replenish it, the hydrostatic pressure drops.
Yes. The natural outward push of the freshwater collapses. It basically creates a subterranean vacuum.
And the ocean is just sitting right there, heavy and salty, completely ready to fill it.
Exactly.
The heavy seawater gets sucked laterally into those coastal aquifers, and then it wicks upward into the soil profile.
And so the roots of the crops are essentially being soaked in seawater.
Wow.
The intrusion is sterilizing the soil from below. In the northern Nile Delta, this process is actively converting prime, farmable earth into hypersaline dead zones.
That's devastating.
Two of Egypt's absolute worst land degradation hotspots sit directly on the coast, entirely driven by the sea invading the terrestrial aquifers.
So a summit about soil held in Egypt is inherently a coastal event, whether they explicitly put it on the billboard or not.
It really is.
The sea is actively claiming the degraded land. The terrestrial breakdown drives marine consequences. And the marine environment exploits the terrestrial weakness.
And that feedback loop brings us right back to the central tension of that atmospheric delivery system we started with.
The dust blowing over the Red Sea.
Right. Because if the UNCCD fails to contain global desertification, the inevitable physical outcome is a higher volume of topsoil turning into airborne dust.
And we established that a baseline of dust feeds the Red Sea reef. But the critical question for marine biologists is, what happens to the ecosystem when you crank the dial and permanently pump significantly more dust into the water?
And this is where the marine biology literature gets highly complex. It reveals a seemingly contradictory reality.
Yeah, our sources detail two separate studies analyzing the effects of this dust on the Red Sea ecosystem, specifically focusing on common coral species. And the findings point in entirely different directions.
Depending on which biological scale you examine, yeah.
Let's start with the first study, which focused on coral resilience. Researchers subjected coral to intense heat stress, which is, you know, the paramount concern right now with warming ocean temperatures causing mass bleaching.
Right, the heat is killing them.
But when they introduced the desert dust to those heat-stressed corals, the results were dramatic.
Mm.
Their net photosynthesis, the core engine of their energy generation, it spiked to 10 times the normal rate.
10 times.
Yeah, 10 times higher.
That is a massive biochemical fortification against thermal duress.
Right.
And the researchers noted that this resilience wasn't solely due to the iron in the dust. It was the synergistic effect of the entire trace metal cocktail.
Ah.
The manganese, the zinc, the copper, they were all acting together to biochemically shield the coral from the heat.
And, you know, human nature craves a simple narrative. It is so tempting to look at that first study and just conclude that desertification is actually a net positive for the reef.
Right. More dust equals heat-resistant, supercharged coral, case closed.
Exactly. But that binary good or bad label falls apart entirely when you look at the second study.
Because the second study zoomed out from the individual coral polyps, they analyzed the foundational architecture of the marine food web.
Okay, what did they do?
Well, researchers tracked the actual water column in the Red Sea through two severe naturally occurring sandstorms.
Oh, wow. In real time.
Yeah, in real time. And they focused on the bacteria populations, which form the absolute base layer of the oceanic ecosystem.
And the shift they documented during those sandstorms is jarring.
Completely jarring.
The bacteria that manufacture their own food, the producers of the ecosystem, they plummeted.
Right.
While simultaneously, the bacteria that do not make their own food, but instead scavenge and consume organic material floating around them, they just exploded in numbers.
The entire microscopic economy flipped. The consumers dominated the producers.
Which is wild.
Yeah, and this massive structural shift in the microbial community, it peaked in under a week after the sandstorm hit.
So fast.
Very fast. Now, in the context of this specific study, the microbial community did manage to restabilize and return to its baseline within about a month after the acute event passed.
Right, but a sandstorm is an acute temporary shock.
Exactly.
The authors of the study issued a stark warning about the long-term trend. If global desertification increases the chronic daily baseline of dust settling on the sea, you're no longer dealing with a temporary shock.
No, it becomes the new normal.
Right. You risk permanently rewiring the microbial food web. You could end up with an ocean dominated by scavenging consumers rather than producers, which would fundamentally alter the food chain for every single fish and coral in the ecosystem.
So both of these scientific realities stand in permanent tension.
Yeah.
A specific intermittent dose of dust acts as a critical thermal shield for the coral.
Right.
But an elevated permanent baseline of that exact same dust threatens to dismantle the planktonic ecosystem the coral relies on to survive.
It's basically a paradox. It is exactly like a highly potent medication.
That's a good way to put it.
At the prescribed dosage, it cures the heat stress and boosts photosynthesis tenfold. But overdose the system by allowing unchecked desertification to pump too much dust into the water, and the side effects fundamentally rewrite the ecosystem's operating system.
And we can't neatly resolve this tension because the ecosystem itself just teeters on this knife edge. The negotiations at the 2028 UN summit will literally dictate the dosage of dust falling into the oceans for decades to come.
So as we look toward that 2028 summit, the geopolitical board is set, but several massive pieces are still in motion.
Very much so.
We know Egypt is the host country, but crucially, the UN has not yet announced the host city.
Right, so we can't just guess Sharm el-Sheikh yet.
No, we have to wait for the official diplomatic announcement before projecting the logistics of the event.
And the exact dates in 2028 also remain unconfirmed.
And procedurally, the central conflict is completely up in the air. Will the global community actually agree to the legally binding drought protocol that Egypt's water minister is demanding? Or will they just default to voluntary measures?
And that single procedural debate, I mean, that will ripple through terrestrial agriculture and marine ecosystems alike.
Yeah.
Watching how that specific negotiation unfolds is critical for anyone tracking land conservation, water security, or marine biology.
Because at the end of the day, they are all the exact same fight.
They really are.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We asked you to take a detour away from the colorful reefs and into the dry mechanics of UN land policy. And hopefully it is clear now that the detour was actually a straight line.
The decisions made about the sand will write the future of the sea.
Exactly. But we want to leave you with one final thought to mull over on your own, building on the research we unpacked today. If land desertification is directly altering the microscopic foundation of the ocean's food web through increased dust storms, how far inland do we actually need to look before we realize we are already studying marine biology?
That's a great question.
Think about it. We'll catch you next time.